bread and butter is teaching. And that teaching that we do of course needs to be on a very high intellectual and academic level. Two of the subjects which we all teach, of course, are Tanakh and Gemara. And the subject for this session is resources in the academics. Bread and butter is teaching. And that teaching that we do of course, needs to be on a very high intellectual and academic level. Two of the subjects which we all teach, of course, are Tanakh and Gemara. And the subject for this session is resources in the academic study of Tanakh and Gemara. The presentation will be made by Rabbi Dr. Yaakov Elman. Rabbi Elman is a professor at Yeshiva College and the Bernard Revel Graduate School.
Thank you very much. I especially thank Rabbi Kupchik and Rabbi Hertz for inviting me here for my own very special reason. I mentioned to Rabbi Hertz that when I started teaching in the college, students came up to me and asked me for bibliographies. And, you know, making a bibliography is not a small job. And if you're teaching, you know, a heavy load and doing other things as well, it becomes rather... it's so time-consuming, you just keep putting it off. They forced me to sit down and prepare bibliographies, and now I have bibliographies which I can give out to students as well. So I have to thank them for that. You know what? If there's one phrase that I can use to encapsulate the trend, the tendency, the dynamic of traditional lumdus in the widest sense of the term, it's a Gemara in Bukharis that you may or may not be aware of, but you've heard the phrase, I'm sure. It's Bukharis daf vuv umid beis. Hecha deikel medrash darshinin. Wherever we can darshin, we darshin. And this goes not just for psukim, which is what the sugya there is talking about, famous tmeis. It goes for everything. In other words, in the wider sense of the phrase, darshin, it means to give the maximum amount of meaning to every text that we encounter, whether it's Chumash, whether it's Nach, whether it's Gemara, whatever it may be. And that's basically what Rabbanim are about, what Talmid HaChachamim are about, Lamdanim are about. And more than any particular question of a steer between modern scholarship and lumdus in Chazals or whatever else, in there lies the rub between modern scholarship and lumdus in the most general sense. Because what is morally meaningful is not necessarily what scholars take as being the most important part of a text, no matter what the text is. And because of that, scholars usually look for things that Rabbanim don't, Chachamim don't. And I have to kind of apologize to you in that what I'm going to be dealing with are things that are not morally edifying necessarily. Sometimes, by accident, it works out that way, but it's not the Chavana. So you're going to spend an hour and a half looking at the state of modern scholarship on matters having to do with Torah Shebikhtav and Torah Shebaal Peh. And I tell you frankly, right at the outset, I don't know that you're going to find a lot of useful material for drushes, even for classes, unless you have a very select clientele, if you're in university town and so on, things like that, when there's a certain sensibility, a certain academic sensibility that you sometimes have to cater to. Nevertheless, I was asked to do it, and I'm glad to do it. And I will try to show you, in some cases, how it can, you know, even things that are kind of morally neutral can be used, for the edification of your Mispalim, your Talmidim, and so on. To start that, If you'll take out the single sheet, which has all these strange lines on it, I'll show you something that some of you may be aware of. This is taken from a source that I'm sure most of you have in the house. As a matter of fact, let me ask, how many people recognize this page? These two. So I'm going to tell you something most of you don't know. This is from Nechama Leibovitz on Shmos. And what you have here is, if you take a look on the left-hand side, you have the beginning of Va'era. Vaidavar Elokim, Moshe, Va'emelov, etc., etc., Ani Hashem. Now notice that this whole parasha begins with Ani Hashem and it ends with Ani Hashem. And you see the lines on the side here indicate that. More than that, it's punctuated in the middle with Ani Hashem. Moreover, if you call the first four lines A, B, C, D, what you find here is you have a pattern of A, B, C, D, D, C, B, A. Meaning that an inyan that's taken up at the very beginning is again taken up at the very end. Something that's taken up second comes out next to the end, next to the last, etc. And for example, take a look at the second pasuk for Erel Avram El Yitzchak El Yaakov Bekel Shakai, which may Hashem Lodati Lehem. If you follow the lines to the next to the last, so again you have a mention of the others. Veveisi Eskim Al Haaretz Eshem Asasi Esyadi Laseisos Al Avram Yitzchak El Yaakov. There's a lot to say about this. The point I want to make is this. What you have here is kind of an envelope, a series of envelopes in which the central message is to be found in the middle. So that if you look in the middle, you see Ani Hashem, Votzeisi Esam Mitachas Sidlos Mitzrayim, Vitzalti Esam Evodasam, Vigalti Esam Mizor Netui. In other words, you've got the full Lashonos of Geula. The five. More than that, if you see the last line in that central message, that core, you have Ohayisi Lachem Elokim Vidatem Ki Ani Hashem Elokechem. The Chama Leibovitz points out that this is the very first time in Chumash that the word Elokim is used with a kinoi, meaning your guard. This is a declaration that Hashem is now choosing Klal Yisrael as his people, and that he is then their God, your God. So what you see here is that the repetitions on the bottom serve a purpose beyond what you might find in the Malbim, and different from what you would find in the Malbim. In other words, here you have a repetition. Usually, if you have a repetition, you're looking for a chilek, you're looking for a drasha. In this case, the repetitions serve to encapsulate the central message and to point out its importance. So here you have a pattern which is, as I said, the repetitions themselves are less important than what they encapsulate. This is the kind of thing, these kinds of patterns are the kinds of things that scholars, one sort of biblical scholar, one large minority of biblical scholars look for, and you find them all over Tanakh. You find them, for example, if you take a look in Yeshaya 14, you can do exactly the same kind of analysis with these kind of envelopes. Technically, they're called inclusios, where you have beginning and the end of the relatively the same, and then, you know, there's a central core message. And sometimes you find it without any great central core message, and then you have a challenge to figure out why the Mechaber, or here Hashem, went to the trouble of doing this encapsulation. Nevertheless, the pattern is a pattern. Some cases you'll find scholars push to find the pattern because it's all the rage these days, and it's a nice thing to find. And sometimes you wonder, does it really exist? But in most cases, I have to say that it does. In this case, you'll go through it, you'll see that it really does exist. Is this something you can easily use in a drasha? I don't think so. If you use it in a class, it makes all the more, you know, it points up the importance of the point that's being made here, that Hashem is choosing Klal Yisrael. And part of that choosing means that he's going to give them Eretz Yisrael, they'll get the Torah, etc., etc. But as I said, this is not necessarily the usual result of looking for these patterns. But it's something that sometimes happens. mutatis mutandis, mutandum, there is another kind of pattern that you can find. I'm going to kind of do it all at once, and then we'll go into bibliography. If you take another one of the sheets, the one that says page 8 and page 9 on the bottom. Again, one of the single sheets. What you have here is an outline of the first sugya in Pesachim. In two columns, the first column, which is headed Nusach HaVolgata, is the Nusach of that sugya as you find it in our Gemaras. On the left-hand side, you have Lishnach Brina, which is the sugya as you find it in certain manuscripts. The Yemenite manuscript of Pesachim is one, and there are a few others. Munich 6, not that it matters. These are Oriental manuscripts, generally. And if you recall, the sugya there deals with the question of Or Larba Aser, is Or, it's a Machlokas Amoraim, is Or night or day? And you have a whole stream of rayas one way or the other, from Sukkim, from Mishnas, from Brises, trying to prove that Or is one or the other. You have 12 rayas. Now, what you find, and in our Gemaras, what you have is they all start with Meisvei. If you see, you go down the list, you'll see 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on. You have actually 13 Meisveis and 2 Toshmas at the end. If you look in the manuscripts, what you find is a very interesting and very symmetrical pattern. You start out with, if you go on the left-hand side, you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 Meisveis or Mosiveis, as the Tzaviat has. Then you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 Toshmas. You have another Mosiv and then another 3 Toshmas. And they're not haphazard, because if you go through, you'll see that what you find is the first three. There's a problem with the third, but the first three start, conclude or is day. Then you have the first five, first four. And then you have, three. Then you have three yamamas and another three artas. The idea is that these things are not haphazard, and the meisveis and the toshmas come in opposite directions. And what you have is in the middle, you have an alternate kind of raya. This is something that's purely formal. It has nothing much to do with the inyan itself. There's another kind of pattern that you find that does have something to do with the inyan, and that's in the next, if you look at the next single page. And that is, this is the first sugya in Moisha Rabba, in Yevamos, where the question is, Eid Echad Neman, where do you learn it out from? And what you find is three layers of rayas. If you look on page 393 on the left-hand side, first of all, they start out, is it Midoraisa? They try three rayas, it doesn't work. Is it a svara? Again, they try three rayas and it doesn't work. And then they work up to the sugya works up to the conclusion. Ella, Amar Abzeir, Mitol Shachomer Shachmat, Ola Abisof, and so on. There's a Machlokas Rishonim, Sof Kol Sof, what it means. Most Rishonim hold that this is a Takanes Chachamim. Some nevertheless hold that it's the Raisa. What you find, though, is that because there is this arrangement of three rayas one way and three, from Psukim, and three rayas from Svara, and you also have, to begin with, you have three rayas from Brises or Mishnas, you sometimes have a raya, and the Rishonim talk about this, a raya where the raya is not much of a raya. And the question then is, why is the raya there? And what happens is, and this happens very often, and the Rishonim sometimes point it out, but not in this, not so much within the context of the pattern. Sometimes an Amora prepares, or the Gemara prepares you for the real conclusion, the real Maskana, by giving you a Raya that's not such a great Raya. Tysus points this out in a number of places. What happens here is, because there's a pattern here that the Bala Sugya wanted to arrange, he sometimes put in a riot that wasn't such a great riot, just to give you three riots in a symmetrical way. I'll give you another example. Shmaminot Klas is by far the most common Shmaminot that you find in Shas. Four is not really a number. I mean, it happens, Shmaminot Arba, but not very often. Two is not really a number either. If you want to know something, you know, a number of things, learn a number of things from a mucker, you learn three riots, three dinim. Shmaminot Klas. Sometimes we show them have a problem. What's this third one? It's no big chiddush. Why do you have to be told it? And again, it's because of the form. You need three riyas, or three dinim rather, and in order to work your way up to three, they'll put something in that's not so strong. If you're aware of these patterns, sometimes it saves you a lot of yigir yisera, trying to work out an Indian of Lumdis, which really doesn't work because the sugya doesn't work that way. It works, the sugya is arranged, some sugyas, not all sugyas, but many sugyas, especially, let me tell you, introductory sugyas that introduce a mesechta or a perek, tend to go this way. There's a literary pattern here. This may have been because whoever gave the shir and the yeshiva, you know, like it was certainly a festive occasion beginning a new mesechta, and so this is part of what you did. I don't know. You know, it would seem something like that, but this does work. And you see here at the beginning of Pesachim and the beginning of Yeshua Rabbah, and it's the kind of thing you sometimes should look for, or maybe always look for, when you come across a sugya that doesn't seem to be doing everything that you expect it to be doing. This is the kind of thing that modern scholarship looks for. In a sense, this goes counter, in a large sense, it goes counter to what you expect, what you've been trained for in yeshiva, and how you've been learning all your lives. And so I offer this with a certain amount of diffidence, but if you look, you'll see that it works more often than not, and if it works, it works. What can you say? The idea here is that a literary pattern has its own value. Even though it doesn't come out, there's no chiddush in halacha, or there's no musar haskel, if it's a pasuk. Nevertheless, it's there because, for some reason, either Hashem in the case of the Torah, the Navi in the case of Nach, or the Amoraim in the case of the Gemara, felt that this was an inyan. And I'll just point out to you, there's a very interesting taisvus, second taisvus in Ezel Neshef, in Bava Mitzvah Daf Samach, in Beis. The Gemara there says, Rava says, that you have a pasuk, es kaspach lo sitein b'neshech v'tarbis lo sitein ochlecha. You hear, it's a halachic pasuk, the lav of ribis, given in parallelism, if you know. In other words, you have one half of a pasuk, which says basically the same thing the second half of the pasuk says. So Rava says, so lama chilken akasav, lav ala b'shnei lav. In other words, the reason you have es number one, number two is so that there's an union of two lavim by ribbis. Taisus asks a very interesting question. Taisus asks, if that's the only reason for this repetition, then why change the wording? Why is neshech and tarbis? Gemara there there's a long hakdama where the Gemara points out that you cannot have neshech without tarbis and tarbis without neshech. So, Ibizai, what do you need them both? In other words, why not just have his kaspach lo sitin lo b'neshech, or b'neshech lo sitin achlecha, or tarbis tarbis? That's the question Taisus asks. And Taisus says, it could be, and there are a few Taisus in all in Bava Metzia, as a matter of fact, that say this in other contexts. It could be that since the Torah had to repeat the Isser because of lav ala b'shnei lavim, it changed the wording because it's no'e yoser. It's more aesthetically pleasing. Okay, so what Taisus does here is Taisus takes a pasuk, which is a halachic pasuk, which is nevertheless in poetic form, meaning it's kefil inya b'milim shonos, and halachically there's no difference between the two halves of the pasuk. But aesthetically, there is a difference. And that's the only, according to Tysus, it seems, that's the only justification for having this Neshech and Tarbis in the same pasuk. It's aesthetically pleasing to change the lashon instead of repeating the same word, you know, in the pasuk. This is certainly, I think, a pesach, a yesod, you know, for this kind of search for patterns in psukim, gemara, sugis, etc., etc. Even without, as I said, in this case, what Tysus is saying very clearly, there's no chiluk lahalacha in this repetition. So heched ikal medrash darshinin has a limit, and the limit in this case is where we know halachically there is no chiluk. So then you have to explain the pasuk in a different way, and what Tysus says, I explain it in terms of aesthetics, which shows you that aesthetic appeal has some kind of a role to play. Even in our Makairis, Sukkim, Mishnas, Gemaras, Sugyas, and so on. With that apology, let me go through some bibliographical items, actually more than some. I think we've got 9 pages here. But I'm not going to go through every book here necessarily. What I want to do is point out to you that scholarship is different from lumdus in another sense. And that is that in a very self-conscious way, academic scholars feel themselves to be part of a field which has a direction. And you assume that that field is progressing. You're learning more things, and you're sometimes making important discoveries. And what is 20 or 30 years old in most fields, certainly in science and also sometimes in the humanities, some of the humanities, is out of date and obsolete and superseded. This is not the way we think of it. You know, there's a little of that makom hinichu liskadabo. If you look at the Hakdamah of the Megillas Esther to Sefer Mitzvos, you have. He talks about when an Achman can say something that a Rishon didn't know, you know, when the Achman spends a lot of time on an Indian that the Rishon didn't consider important enough to spend a lot of time. But by and large, we don't think that we're going to make great new discoveries, and we're going to chas v'shalom, we're going to supersede what Rishonim or Achronim say. That's not our whole gestalt. It's not our whole way of looking at things. Nevertheless, scholarship does have this idea. And sometimes, because you do have the idea, you find things that ordinarily you wouldn't find. If you don't expect to find anything that you're not, that, you know, then you won't, obviously. If you don't expect to find, you won't find. If you have a havamina that you will find, then sometimes you find, sometimes you won't find. Sometimes you think you found something, it's not really so. And of course, remember something. With scholarship, always, in light of everything I said, is you have to say, always have to be kabdeu v'chashdeu. Because not only are they coming from a different angle and going to a different angle than you are, but there's also a certain amount of self-serving quality. I mean, publish or perish means that academics have to publish whatever they publish in order to get tenure, to get advancement, and so on. And so therefore, there's necessary, you know, by the very fact that most people are not great b'chachim, Kayach HaChidish is not evenly distributed, they're going to be writing things that are not very new or not very astounding or not very valid. So you have to be very careful when it comes to consuming scholarship. What I'm going to be talking about now is trends in scholarship rather than specific books. I will talk about specific books, especially the ones that have impressed me and that I found very useful. But books, because of the very fact that you're dealing with fields here, fields of endeavor and fields of learning, don't come as separate, you know, packets. They come as part of a trend, part of a school. And so therefore, it's not enough to point out that here's a book. You have to understand where that book is coming from, what the Mechaber's assumptions are, what school he belongs to, and so on. We're going to do a little of that. So you're going to have kind of a very quick survey what's been doing in academic scholarship in the last 10, 15 years, let's say. But by and large, these books have been books that were published in the last year or two, with a few exceptions. Now, because there are a lot of colleges, a lot of universities, and therefore a lot of people teaching and a lot of people doing research. There's a lot being published, mainly, as I said, because you have to. So therefore, scholars themselves feel the need for review articles, and bibliographies, and so on. And periodically you find them. And sometimes they become very large projects indeed. It's like it gives you, you have a whole book published that gives you the status, the state of the field at a certain point. And right, if you take a look at the select bibliography, Torah Shabbat Ksav and Related Matters, the very first entry is Mikra, text, translation, reading, and interpretation of the Hebrew Bible and ancient Judaism and early Christianity. Excuse me for the early Christianity, I didn't write the book. But this is the book. I mean, this is not a small book. It's also not a cheap book, by the way. This is a review copy. I wouldn't have been able to afford it otherwise. However, I'm assuming that you have access to libraries. What this is just that. This is an introduction, or rather a survey, of a whole bunch of matters, of fields that relate to Torah Shabbat Ksav. So it starts off with a long chapter on writing in ancient Israel and early Judaism by people who, you know, in other words, this is a survey of everything we know about how much literacy there was. And then there's one that a chapter that you probably will skip if you would look at it, called The Formation of the Hebrew Bible, which has all kinds of problems. You will note that with one exception, on this, you haven't had a chance to look at the bibliography, there's nothing here on Chumash. And the reason for that is, and in a sense I can answer the question that was asked, when it comes to Chumash, the distance between traditional learning and academic scholarship is so wide, by and large, that there's almost no communication possible between us. On the one hand, you have, you know, a book that is divine, in which case, therefore, there are all kinds of judgments that you can't make about it, because how are you going to stand up and say, I know how God would have written a book? So once we make the assumption that God wrote this book, there are all kinds of things that you can't do that scholars have been doing for a long time. The apikarsis of the documentary hypothesis is not so much the documentary hypothesis as the previous kfira before the kfira, kfira le kfira. And that is to assume that a human being, you know, Moshe Rabbeinu wrote the Torah. Once you assume that, say, oh, well, what do you mean? How could Moshe Rabbeinu write in so many different styles and so on and so forth? And then you come up with, you know, what's called the documentary hypothesis. But if you start out by saying Moshe Rabbeinu didn't write it, it's divine, so what are you going to say? That Hashem is not, it's not possible for Hashem to write his Torah in different ways, different styles, and so on and so forth. So that being the case, I have almost nothing here on Chumash, because in order to do academic Bible study in the realm of Chumash, you have to, at the very least, pay lip service to the documentary hypothesis, and at the very most, as they do in Germany to this day, take it very, very seriously. Since we're not about to take it very seriously, the scar, yet the scar of Efsedo in looking at these things, by and large. But as I said, for other things, you have a nice survey of the field, some better, some worse. The Targum chapter is, in particular, is not bad at all. Now, there's another one, if you take a look at the very third, there's a book that was just published a couple of months ago by Wayne State University Press, which I have not had a look at. But since it is a very recent survey of the state of Jewish studies, which is its title, I decided to put it in this bibliography. Wayne State is sending me a copy. I should have it, but by the time I get it, it's obviously going to be too late. But it should do something. Now, in the middle, I have a book that's not new, and I'm not altogether sure that it's in print, but I recommend it very highly, because it's by Rav Kupferman of the Mikvah La'an Yerushalayim, called the Pshuto Shel Mikra, collection of articles on that theme. And why do I put it in here? I put it in here because it's one of the few books that presents an orthodox approach to Chumash, which takes things not in an ad hoc manner, that here's a kashan, here's a teretz, here's a kashan, here's a teretz, but gives you an approach that you can go through all the Chumash with. And I think that's very important. It's something that it may be, I don't say that it is so, but maybe it may be that Rav Kufman learned from modern academic scholarship, not that he would like to admit it, but the idea that there is an approach that should be tried out on the whole body of Chumash is something that we don't find very often. Malvin had that idea also, I will say. Now, another thing about scholarship is that it's always changing. It's changing partly because, especially when it comes to Bible, there are all kinds of new discoveries. What do I mean by new discoveries? I mean new archaeological excavations, texts that are uncovered, inscriptions that are uncovered, statues, all kinds of idols also that are uncovered. And what is the scholarly orthodoxy in interpreting these things in one generation changes radically in another. You cannot set your star by scholarship. In other words, you can sometimes find things that will support your position. Archaeology on the whole probably yields more problems than solutions. Nevertheless, I've listed two histories of ancient Israel, Bright's and Miller's and Hayes. Bright, you'll have relatively few difficulties with. Bright was a student of W.F. Albright. I don't know if the name means anything to you, but he was a guy in Ay of Yisrael, which is not necessarily doesn't help his scholarship, but he was. And he also believed very much that most of Tanakh, but again, he was a scholar, and as a Christian, he didn't have to believe in the total, at least not his type of Christianity, total infallibility of Tanakh. Nevertheless, by and large, he was Mekayim Tanakh as an historical source, and his students likewise. And Bright's history is the one history that represents the Albright school of the history of ancient Judaism. That means the third edition. Yeah. This school has been under attack already for 20 years. In other words, those of you who may, have read, let's say, Werner Keller's book, The Bible as History, it's still a nice book, but it's not the way the scholarship is going. The scholarship is going the other direction. As a matter of fact, William Dever, Recent Archaeological Discoveries and Biblical Research, I don't know, I'm not sure that I put him in the bibliography, but I'm bringing him here for a reason. The reason is this. This is a book that was published in 1990. These were the Samuel Althea Strum Lectures in Jewish Studies at the University of Washington. You may be aware. He is there. Okay. Now, he's there for a reason. To show you, not necessarily that I'm recommending the book, but to show you the danger of relying on archaeology. He is a very prominent archaeologist. This book is the result of lectures given under Jewish auspices. A Jewish couple founded a lecture series at the University of Washington, which has had some very prestigious speakers. Yosef Dan spoke there. Yosef Yerushalmi from Columbia University gave an excellent series of lectures, which are a fantastic book. Zachor. Here you have, he's in the same lecture series, and what essentially he's saying is that Albright was wrong. There are a lot of problems with taking archaeology as a support for Tanakh, for what we find, and the history is given in Tanakh, and you basically should just abandon the job. For example, one small but telling point, you may be aware of the fact that there are a lot of statuettes of pregnant women that have been dug up in Israelite layers of tells in Eretz Yisrael. And for at least two generations, the assumption has been that these were kameis. These were amulets used by pregnant women to ease the birth pangs. Dever absolutely denies this. He reinterprets them as being mamish avodah zarah. So the difference is, of course, were they ovdei avodah zarah, were they not ovdei avodah zarah in Eretz Yisrael? He then comes out and says that they were ovdei avodah zarah. In other words, an avodah zarah was very, very widespread over a long period of time, not just, let's say, during the reign of Menashe, and that it had spread to all sectors of the population. This is not necessarily a steerer to what we have in Pesukim, but on the other hand, it's part of a process of reinterpretation which will certainly make us less comfortable with the way we view Tkufas HaTanach. And he moves away, aside from that, he's basically the head of a movement which is trying to bury what's called biblical archaeology. In other words, he prefers to call the archaeology of Eretz Yisrael Syro-Palestinian archaeology. And this is not so much a political move as an academically political move, meaning that you don't dig to try to find out what the Bible said and to show that it's right. You dig for your own purposes and the chips fall where they may. I'm not saying that that's wrong, but sometimes if you come assuming that the chips are going to fall the wrong way, that's somehow the way the interpretations go. So if you look at to archaeology as has been done for a long time as a source of comfort, it's no longer a source of comfort for Yidden who are looking for something that will help them understand Tanakh. Essentially, what you're going to find is that more and more archaeologists are going to tell you that this part of Tanakh is unhistorical and this part of Tanakh is unhistorical. This account in Yoshua just doesn't fly, and so on and so forth. And even on my most kind of left-wing days, I can't see that as being very useful to us. Now, let me talk about something that I think it can be very useful and is actually a very strong movement in biblical scholarship, and that is the kind of thing that is best represented, and I recommend this book very, very highly, by a book that was published by Indiana University Press called The Poetics of Biblical Narrative. The Poetics of Biblical Narrative, which surveys and investigates all the ways that Tanakh tells a story and all the devices it uses to tell a story, including things like repetitions, gapping, which means it doesn't tell you vital facts that you have to know in order to cast doubt on the way things are happening. For example, when Uriah Achiti comes home from the field because David HaMelech wants him to sleep with his wife, he refuses. He refuses because how can he go to sleep with his wife when his men are in the field fighting? If you go through that parsha in Shmuel, it's impossible to tell whether Uriah suspected something or not. Was he meisiach lefi tumo, and he meant pashut? How can I go and have the comforts of home when my men are bivouacked out in the field in danger? Or I'm going to stay here with you in the palace because I know what you're about. That he suspected that David HaMelech had slept with Bathsheba and that he wanted to Uriah to come home to cover for him. It's impossible to tell, and depending on how you interpret that very crucial point in the story is how you will understand David HaMelech and how you understand Uriah, how you understand the whole story. According to Sternberg, the Mechaber did this b'chavona, with malice aforethought, in order to raise all these possibilities in the reader's mind. And there's a wealth of insight. In other words, it's an oblique critique of David HaMelech, an oblique one, not a direct one. There's a wealth of insight of this sort in this book, and I recommend it very highly. It's the kind, as I said, this is part of a movement which does a literary reading of Tanakh, which is not to degrade and denigrate Tanakh as merely literature, not so. Punkt verkehrt. It's to show the wealth of insight that you can find in Tanakh, because it tells a story and how it tells a story and what it does and what it doesn't do. As I say, I cannot speak highly enough of this. And while I'm about that, and as you'll see here, narratology and related methods, there's a whole list of books along those lines. Let me read to you from a book that was published actually quite a while ago, 1952, called Mimesis. Let me, have people here heard about this? One person, okay. In that case, I'm safe. Mimesis was written by Eric Auerbach. It's called, the subtitle is The Representation of Reality in Western Literature. You are not going to be interested in 95% of the book, 90% of the book. 90% of the book deals with Western literature of the 14th century, 15th century, 18th century, and so on. The first chapter is the one that has kind of assumed, the book itself is a classic, but the first chapter has assumed the status of a classic in biblical studies. It's called Odysseus's Scar, and what Eric Auerbach does in that chapter is he compares the narrative technique of Homer, Lahavdil, with Tanakh. And he shows that while Homer presents his characters in a very flat way, what you see is what you get and there's nothing behind them. What you find in Tanakh, and particularly he deals with the Akedah, is a character in the round. Avraham Avinu has depth to him, has profundity to him. It's not just a flat, cartoon-like character. And in a sense, what all the books that are listed here and others that are not listed try to do is try to show you how it is that Tanakh manages that feat. Let me just quote. It says, "It would be difficult to imagine styles more contrasted than those of these two equally ancient and equally epic texts," meaning Homer and Chumash in this case. "On the one hand, externalized, uniformly illuminated phenomena." That's what you have in Homer. "At a definite time and in a definite place, connected together without lacunae, without gaps, in a perpetual foreground," meaning it's all up front, there's nothing behind the scenes. There's nothing, you know, it's like, you know, you look behind the character and he's hollow. "Thoughts and feelings completely expressed." There's no subconscious, there's no undercurrent in the mind. What you see, as I said, is what you get. "Events taking place in a leisurely fashion with very little suspense." That's Homer. "On the other hand," meaning in Tanakh and Chumash, "the externalization of only so much of the phenomena as is necessary for the purpose of the narrative." In other words, the only facts that are presented are the things that are absolutely vital for you to know in order to understand the story. There's nothing that is, there's no, as we would say in our language, there's no yitalashin. Everything there is told with economy, and so if there's something that you find in Chumash or in Tanakh, it's there for a reason. You have to understand it. "The decisive points of the narrative alone are emphasized. What lies between is non-existent. Time and place are undefined and call for interpretation." This is part of it. It mamish requires the reader to take an active role in formulating the narrative. The narrative doesn't exist outside the reader, and the reader has to bring his own understanding to it. "Thoughts and feelings remain unexpressed, are only suggested by the silence and fragmentary speeches." And this is part of where you get the feeling that there's something behind these characters. There's more to it than meets the eye, and you have to look into it and see what's really going on. "The whole permeated with the most unrelieved suspense and directed toward a single goal, remains mysterious and," quote, "fraught with background," unquote, which is, again, saying the same thing that I just said. This chapter in a book which was written by somebody who was not a biblical scholar, and I think he knew some Hebrew, not necessarily a lot, and he basically worked with translations, but his feeling, his ear for the narrative was, you know, for literary effects was so great that he could, even through, you know, through the blanket of translation, understand something of what's doing in biblical narrative that was not properly appreciated before. And as I said, this has now spawned a whole movement, and there are a lot of books along these lines, all of which have something to contribute. However, let me warn you. I mean, unfortunately, the job here is both to kind of encourage you to come in and also to remind you that it can be dangerous. Most people who write these books, obviously not from some, most, many of them are not even Jewish. And they also are academics in the sense that they partake of an academic culture which is anti-authoritarian and is in love with ambiguity. There's no psak halacha there. So when you read these, sometimes what you come out with is a feeling that everything is undetermined and there's no final conclusion that you come out with. And punkt faket, that's exactly what the Mechaber wanted. He wanted to tell you that things are, you will never get to the real truth. Now this is a very modern conception. And one of the criticisms of this movement is that what we're doing is we're reading into ancient texts modern conceptions. Well, obviously, the truth of the matter is, we're in that business too when we darshan. And that a good darshan does that all the time. And the question here is, you know, whose drushes do you prefer? I think that, and this is my personal opinion, and you may disagree, I think that one of the problems with Yiddishkeit today is that we are not alive to, and we are very suspicious of ambiguity. We want everything to be black and white. I remember a phenomenon where everything has to be, there is certainly that trend in halakha that you can find from before, you know, before modern times, but certainly now that we have measurements, the facility to make measurements so easily and so exactly, so halakha follows suit. And so therefore we know that the achilas process is 9 minutes. Did the Chasam Sofer know that it was 9 minutes? You know, well, maybe in his days already. I should have asked Rabbi Bly. Things of that sort. I know I was told on good authority by that the Mishnah Brewers.
There's this antipathy to ambiguity and to letting things go. You have to pin it down exactly. You recall that the Yerushalmi tradition says that Sarah wasn't given Fatima, in that sense, sealed and deliberate, nailed down with every decision made, because if it had been, the Shasta Chai and the whole Chai, we wouldn't have been able to exist. And that's Malachi Osiris. So, in a sense, what you find in these books on narratology, which emphasize by and large ambiguities in the text and so on, and intentional ambiguities, something that runs counter to trends in Yiddishkeit today. I think in a sense it may be even better. You know, it might be something that will be useful in tempering those trends, if you can convince anybody that this is valid, obviously. In particular, if you go down the list, Robert Tolzien, Moses and the Deuteronomist, the literary study of the Deuteronomic history. The Deuteronomic history, let me just quickly explain, is the whole history of Klal Yisrael from Yoshua through Malachi. Modern scholars see this as basically a unit that was not officially divided into books, but basically it's one school put together this whole history. And certainly, examines Tanakh, interpreting Tanakh. In other words, we know that the later Sifrei Tanakh quote earlier Sifrei Tanakh, but that's often close to Torah, for example. There's no demarcation, because I didn't want to go on to the fourth page. Wybrae is my one exception in dealing with Finnish. It's a book that deals with Finnish, the making of the Pentateuch, and I do it for a reason. The reason being that here you have a biblical scholar who's basically a right-wing Christian, but a scholar in good standing, who's written a number of commentaries on Tanakh, on various Sifrei Tanakh, who reevaluates all the methodologies involved in producing the documentary hypothesis. And basically, Tanakh become puppets. So they really, style that Tanakh be used as a way of determining authorship, for example. So it simply says we don't know enough about ancient Jewish style. But, Robert Tolden, Moses and the Deuteronomist, a literary study, of the Deuteronomic history. The Deuteronomic history, let me just quickly explain, is the whole history of Klal Yisrael from Yoshua through Malachi. Modern scholars see this as basically a unit that was not officially divided into books, but basically it's one school put together this whole history. And certainly Shmuel and Malachi have a lot in common. At any rate, so here what he does is he examines, it's not only important to see what is being said in a particular piece of, passage in Tanakh, but the question is who says it. If it's said twice, who says it both times? Is it the omniscient narrator and then another character? How is it said? Is it contradicted someplace else? And all of these are things that Tolden considers important in pointing to what the Machaber had in mind and what you should indirectly realize. In other words, it's not only important that somebody says something, but how it's said, who says it, is an important fact. And he continues that in his next volume, Samuel and Deuteronomy. Each one of these has something to contribute in that sense. You may have read also The Art of Biblical Narrative. How many people have? Okay, here we have something that's a bit more popular, archaeological evidence. He's an Egyptologist, a strong Christian Egyptologist, who basically argues, written the way documentary hypothesis people say that Tanakh or other Sifrei Tanakh, other Sifrei Tanakh are written. It's something, again, if you have that problem, if anybody asks the question, here you have an Egyptologist in this family, who's also from Christian, right-wing, obviously, I'm talking about. Not to say he's not a fundamentalist, but he argues in that way. Hallowed book, The Bible and Light of Communal Literature, I mentioned because it's very recent, it came out just really a few weeks ago, but you really have to be interested in biblical archaeology to go through it, but if you are, there it is. King's book is kind of a model of what you do if you want to see what archaeology has to say about a certain book. And he's done almost he's gathered together all the archaeological observations, all the discoveries that are in any way related to these scars, and he gives them to you. Deborah, we already talked about. Walton, again, is something put out by a conservative Christian publishing house, and is usually not only reliable from the scholarly point of view, but reliable from the religious point of view. Sure, if you're really, really courageous, is an interesting examination of Tillim, Pirkei Tillim, in the light of what we know from Ugaritic literature. Ugaritic, do I have to explain what Ugarit was or Ugaritic is? Ugarit is in northern Syria. It was discovered in 1929. If there are texts that are written in a cuneiform alphabet, which was deciphered by two people independently within 3 months, and what was found is a literature, a particular language is very, very close to the Hebrew, very close. Some of it, tomorrow in my intro to Bible class, I will have them reading Ugaritic without very much spec. They will be able to do it because they know the Hebrew. And more than that, you find the poetry in the Ugaritic epic is very close in style to what we find in Tanakh, sometimes to the point that you practically find series of verses, word for word, practically word for word, what you find in Tanakh. Malchusa, Malchusa, Lamin is one case. Hina Adach Hashem, Hina Adach Yoved, Yisrodo Kavori Oven is another case, except of course in Ugarit, they ascribe this to Baal. You know, Hina Adach Baal. But, you know, if you find this, you can learn a lot from what they do and what Tanakh does in a similar way. And sometimes, in particular, if I say something about the whole field, I say doubly about this. But nevertheless, you can think you might get there. Now, the next section is archaeology in the ancient Near East. With all the caveats, nevertheless, discoveries are discoveries. The problems usually come in the interpretation. You know, if you dig something up, the object exists, it's right there. The question is, how do you interpret it? What does it tell you about, Tanakh in general? Hitchens' book, Ancient Orient and Old Testament, is basically an attack on the documentary hypothesis and all the similar theories based on archaeological evidence. He's an Egyptologist, a strong Christian Egyptologist, who basically argues that you never find in the ancient Near East a book written the way documentary hypothesis people say that Tanakh or other super Tanakh, other super Tanakh were written. It's something, again, if you have that problem, if anybody asks you questions, here you have an Egyptologist, English founder, who is also a Christian, right wing, obviously, I'm talking about. Not to say he's not a fundamentalist, but he argues in that way. Hallowed book, the Bible and Life from Literature, I mentioned because it's very, very, recent. It came out just really a few weeks ago. But you really have to be interested in biblical archaeology to go through it. But if you are, there it is. King's book is kind of a model on how many from you know that actually looks like that. Okay, now, very quickly, theology, I will not say anything about Levinson's Sinai and Zion, which I recommend with hesitation, as members of the RCIA in your tradition, and I reviewed the book last year, I think it was, and what I had to say there is, though I haven't changed my mind, if you're interested in the book, read my review first to see what you're getting into. Okay. In that case, what I've done in the end is given you, to the best of my ability, a survey of recent commentaries on books of Tanakh, which do a couple of things. All of them have to be looked at, however, with a certain amount of suspicion, including the very end, the article on Divrei Hayamim, which, by the way, has some very interesting things in it. I don't know how they got through article. But if you look at the introduction, he gives a shot in the Gemara in Bava Basra, which no Rishon Lezion has ever thought of. He may be right, I think he is right, but he doesn't tell you why he has to do this. He has to do it because of the research, because of things that have been happening in biblical research in the last 10 years. But that he can't tell you. He reinterprets the Gemara, and I won't go into detail now, because of the work of Sari Yefet, which is also mentioned here. Okay, so much for the Bible. Now, we don't have much time, so very quickly, let me go through what I've done here. And you'll notice the Torah Shebaal Peh bibliography is much longer than the Torah Shebaal Peh bibliography. There's a reason for that. For one thing, it's a smaller field, and I can be more comprehensive. And so therefore, I figured I might as well go to both and be more comprehensive. All I can give you in Bible is a little smidgen, just a smidgen of what's been published. Here, I can give you more than a smidgen, and I did. As you'll notice, what I didn't do in Bible, I did here. For example, I recommended very specific articles, not just books. Very specific articles that are important in understanding what's going on. Including, without any false modesty on my own. First of all, in general orientation, you have, the first section there, and again, time doesn't permit me to go into any detail, but I think that you have something to learn from all of the articles that I've listed here. General reference, Safrai's book, The Literature of the Sages, in this series that I showed you is a bit smaller, but does the same job for Mishnayos, Tosefta, Bavli, Yerushalmi, Medrashei Halacha, and so on. Likewise, you have Baruch Batzer's annotated, well, Yerushalmi, annotated the Iraqis Guide to the Study of the Palestinian Talmud. It's a very good bibliography, so you have to be careful. But Alter's book is really excellent, and Berlin's book, if you're willing to go with her, is also excellent. Dynamic and Biblical Parallelism, and of course James Kugel, who in a scholarly way, in a sense, makes the Malvin respectable. Very interesting study. He argues that the way scholars have looked at biblical poetry, parallelism, the last 100 years is absolutely wrong. It's not really parallelism. It's not, hey, for Indian, Indian, and Shana, from the Shana say, but that the Malvin was right, that it flows the opposite most of the time. In other words, the second half of the passage goes further than the first half, and it's not strictly parallel. Very interesting book. Hopefully, the film is. I wonder how many film years now that we actually just like that. Okay, now, very quickly, theology. I will not say anything about Levinson's Sinai and Zion, which I recommend with hesitation. It, as members of the RCI, who you have position, and I reviewed the book last year, I think it was, and what I have to say there is, though I haven't changed my mind, if you're interested in the book, read my review first, you'll see what you're getting into. Okay. In that case, what I've done in the end is giving you, to the best of my ability, a survey of recent commentary on books of Tanakh, which, do a couple of things. All of them have to be looked upon with a certain amount of suspicion, including the very end, the article on Divrei Hayamim, which, by the way, has some very interesting things in it. I don't know how they got through article. But if you look at the introduction, he gives a shot with Lauren Bogdanov, which no Rishon Lezion has ever thought of. He may be right, I think he is right, but he doesn't tell you why he has to do this. He has to do it because of the research, because of things that have been happening in biblical research in the last 10 years. But that he can't tell you. He reinterprets the Gemara, and I won't go into detail now, because of the work of Sari Yefet, which is also mentioned here. Okay, so much for the Bible. Now, we don't have much time, so very quickly, let me go through what I've done here, and you'll notice the Perush Baal Peh bibliography is much longer than the Perush Baal bibliography. There's a reason for that. For one thing, it's a smaller field, and I can be more comprehensive, and so therefore I figured I might as well go for both and be more comprehensive. All I can give you in Bible is a real smidgen, just a smidgen of what's been published. Here I can give you more than a smidgen, and I did. As you'll notice, what I didn't do in Bible, I did here. For example, I recommended very specific articles, not just books. Very specific articles that are important in understanding what's going on. Including, without any false modesty on my own. First of all, in general orientation, you have, the first section there, and again, time doesn't permit me to go into any detail, but I think that you have something to learn from all of the articles that I've listed here. General reference, Safrai's book, The Literature of the Sages, is in this series that I showed you, is a bit smaller, but does the same job for Mishnayos, Tosefta, Bavli, Yerushalmi, Medrashei Halacha, and so on. Likewise, you have Baruch Batzer's annotated, well, Yerushalmi, annotated the Iraqi Guide to the Study of the Palestinian Talmud. A very good bibliography on the last 100 years of modern scholarship on the Yerushalmi. Good blot on the Bavli is not as good as Batzer, but it does something. Now, why do I have a listing here for Qumran? Qumran, of course, is the Dead Sea Scrolls. I have the Dead Sea Scrolls listed there because of a discovery that is about to come out. You may have read Larry Shiffman's article in Biblical Review on MMT, Miksas Maasei HaTorah. Has anybody here heard of Miksas Maasei HaTorah is probably the earliest document that we have from the Dead Sea stuff. It's a halakhic text, and it does two things that are very important. Number one, it proves to us that the Prushim, you know, the debates between the Prushim and Stukim that you find in Yadayim and in Pot Rises when there's a diet. So sometimes a form, knowing that this, you know, that this rule applies, that the Brisa will be arranged in this way, tells you something about the actual context. Yerushalmi and Bavli, in particular, what scholars are very interested in these days is how the Bavli got to be what, how it is. Not only in terms of, you know, who and when it was finally finished, but what it's doing. And if you take a look, and with this I guess I'll finish, if you take a look at Kramer, The Mind of the Bavli, An Intellectual History of the Bavli, The Mind of the Talmud, rather, An Intellectual History of the Bavli, which was just published by Apple. This is Talmudic scholarship. One represented by Jacob Neusner, who's now in Florida, and the other one by his teacher, Professor Alivni at Columbia. One of them, the first, says you take a rabbinic document as a whole, meaning the Bavli you take as a whole, because its traits, characteristics as a document outweigh any Makaris in it. And therefore, whoever was in final, you know, the final Mechavim of the Bavli, put their stamp on it to such any rate, some recent work on it, even though these are articles published by people who have access to the text, even though the text has not been published. Finally, not finally, but then quickly, I did my best to give you a more than a selection, but a large selection of critical editions based on Kisvei Yad of, in case Mishnah, you know, Masechtas and Mishnah is, and especially in the Bavli where you have quite a bit, and some Yerushalmi. There may be a few things that I missed, but by and large, this is a pretty good collection of critical editions of Masechtas and Shas. Finally, and that, again, going down page 2, Masechta, there are a few, some new things being done there, especially in terms of how Masechta is arranged and its relationship to the Bavli, which is one of my specialties. And then, going down to Medrash HaHalacha, let me very quickly put in a plug for an article that I published, two JQRs ago. That's The Order of Arguments in Talmud Crisis in Relation to the Conclusion. Very quickly, it's a case where form and content go together. You know, there are a lot of crises, there are 15 actually in the Bavli, and there are 25 in Sifra, etc., that say, that give you an argument. Yeah, A or B, Okalecha Derech Zu, or you might say Okalecha Derech Zu, some people pronounce it that way, or C or D. Talmud Lomar, and then it became a document, Kalacha Tzidu, Psalm Kalacha. And essentially, what the Kramer sees as the message of the Bavli is that the debate is at least as important as the Psalm. And of course, that, it's not irrelevant to point out that he teaches the seminary, and that he is, I guess you would say, a conformed conservative Jew. On the other hand, the challenge of to us, in a sense, is to explain why the Bavli is so open-ended if we are so intent on Pesach Halacha to the extent that we are. And with that, I will end.
Tom, I ever met Dr. Lyman